Today, Robs wants to talk about fire, which is, it seems like a really good idea. It's a cold day. It's going to be the coldest day of the year so far, like 12 degrees, I think, is the high we're going for.
Yes, I was wondering how long it would take for these cold days to... It's been pretty warm, eh? Less wet and warm for the last carrot bar. I always struggle with remembering what it was like last year, but it definitely does seem like it's been a lot wetter and windier than... than usual.
I'd say. After being dry for longer than usual.
But this drop in temperature, definitely an awesome time to sit around a fire and cozy up for winter.
Yes, indeed.
Especially with these clear days as well and the starry nights. It's a beautiful way to celebrate the seasons.
So you used to, we've talked in the past how you used to sleep outside, even in winter.
Especially in winter.
If you're going to sleep outside, you don't mean it if you don't do it in winter.
Especially on the cold, like I say, the cold, crystal clear, even frosty nights are the favourite ones for me to be outside.
Why?
It's just, I don't know, I love it. I feel alive. I sleep out less in summer, funnily enough, I think. I don't know. I think I learn so much. I'm so driven by my learning journey and you know, figuring things out. And I guess when you're in a difficult situation as well, it really it really pushes you to focus and maximize that time, I think.
Presumably you'd be by a fire.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. There's been a few nights where, especially in my earlier days of naturecraft, where I couldn't rely quite as much on my fire skills. Definitely had a few.
Did you wake up and the fire was dead or that sort of thing?
Well, some nights I didn't get a fire going. I don't bring matches or lighters or flint strikes. You know, I'm always using friction fire. But again, these are the nights which teach me so much. It's not the times when it's easy, is fun and comfortable, but the times where it's a real challenge is this one when I learn the most.
What did you learn from being out at night in presumably in the bush, in the forest?
Well, it's definitely an incentive to sharpen your fire making skills, because it's a hard night. But basically, movement. You know, if you don't have a heat source, you need to become the heat source. So,
yeah,
a lot of missioning around and a lot of night walking just to keep warm. And it's easy. I've been in many, many frosty nights, -5 and less with nothing, just wandering around and being toasty warm, but just tired. Yeah, your body's amazing. Like the heat your body pumps out.
Well, I guess if you're trying to produce the heat, like -5 is the coldest I've ever been. I think I was up a mountain, and it was, I remember climbing in the sleeping bag, and it wasn't really warm enough.
Yeah.
And I was in a hut.
Okay.
And I put the bag, I closed the bag over my head to try and keep warm.
Yeah, so
-5 to me seems horrifically cold.
Yeah. From a skills perspective, I don't think the temperature's that important, because... You know, even if it's 10 degrees and you're outside and you don't have a fire, it's uncomfortably cold if you're not moving. But if you do have the skills to make a fire, you can really be as warm as you want to be. Your proximity to the fire and how big your fire is, and you can really just regulate it like a heater at home, I guess.
So what do you do if you are sleeping out and you've got a fire and you want to keep it going all night? Do you just kind of wake up occasionally to feed it? Or
there's many techniques. You can build a fire. It's called an upside-down fire, where you stack it a bit like Jenga with bigger logs at the bottom. And that's my chosen thing because the ground doesn't get hot. It's really safe, the soil... doesn't change temperature, so all the important fungi, microbes in the soil aren't at all affected by me being there.
Yeah,
which is a really important aspect of my nature journey, and that's nice as well because you can build a fire and you can burn for like 3 or 4 days if you put in the time to build it big enough.
Okay,
you know, just put in an ember on top, and you don't need to touch it, and it will just burn and do its thing.
So let's imagine you've got big logs on the bottom on the ground.
Yep.
Progressively smaller logs as you go up.
Yep. Progressively smaller, and each layer to slow it down a bit. You might put some leaf litter or something to fill in the gaps, And then you got real small stuff on top, so it just burns quite fast on the top, and the embers just keep dropping down, yeah. And getting there, preparing the next layer.
So how high would it be above the ground?
Oh, it depends on what, you know, different woods burn, have different sort of burn times, so depending what woods you're using and how long you want it to be for, just keeping me warm overnight, probably just, a foot, 40 centimetres or something.
Okay, all right. I was imagining like a meter or something, but if it was a meter high and you're sleeping on the ground,
yeah, I mean,
you're actually not going to feel it, perhaps.
No, exactly. And it's, you know, there's the rules as well, the unwritten rules of just having enough, you know, just what you need, just taking enough resources for what you need.
Right, yeah.
And, you know, if you do get cold, you just wake up and put another log on. And
So where did these unwritten rules come from?
That's a good question. Where did they come from? I think mostly, you know, I've not really, you know, I've not done a lot of workshops. I had many human tutors, human mentors in my journey. So I think just from connection from the forest, from the bush, and feeling what's the right thing to do, and you know, as humans, what we're able to do, how we're able to live in line and in balance with things, and just out of my love for the natural world, just trying to learn and do everything I can to have the least impact.
It comes from your values as well.
Yeah, I think so.
We're not always, we don't consciously use our values to make decisions. It just kind of happens. So.
But it's, I mean, yeah, I think nature connection's a lot about relationship, and when you do build relationship and you do get to know quite well the beings of the bush, like in any relationship, you just have a level of care for them and want them to be well and want them to be happy, and knowing you're doing things which might, you know, be having the opposite effect, you just naturally sort of do your best to,
yeah,
you know, to help, to do your bit.
So I know you've got a fire workshop coming up. How do you teach people to light fires, presumably without matches?
Yeah.
Well, actually, that would be a waste of time if it was with matches, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, I think people wouldn't be that excited.
Yeah.
But I tell you what, I can light a good match, Aaron. Oh, you should see me. It'll be friction fire techniques.
Yeah.
So, you know, sort of the skills to, well, the wisdom, I guess. The wisdom and the knowledge to light fires without, you know, any brought resources or materials. You know, a knife can be helpful, but not necessary a lot of the time. So just finding certain woods, certain different sticks from the bush, and rubbing them together.
Do you let them try their own way first?
How do you mean their own way?
Like, don't show them anything to start with. Just say, here we are.
Yeah, I don't. Yeah, I mean, I don't like to say this is the way that you have to do it.
Because yeah, I know that about you.
Yeah, that's a shame, because yeah, there might be ways, you know. And I mean, the science of it is you get two bits of material and you rub them together, and friction creates heat.
Yeah,
and then you have a fuel source, which is usually sort of powdered dust, like burnt dust, which is as a byproduct of rubbing two bits of wood together. And if that dust gets hot enough, it can ignite. So that's the basics. And around the world, there's many different ways. You know, different cultures have used different techniques to get to that goal.
Most of us would remember seeing Tom Hanks in Castaway, I think, the movie.
Yeah, yeah. It's quite a good scene, that one.
It's probably what we would, in a desperate moment, it's probably what would come up, I think.
Yeah, but that, you know, that, well, the joy, you know, and when he actually gets that,
yeah,
that flame is something I can really relate to, especially, you know.
Right.
It can be a hard journey, friction fire.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that's what it is. It's a journey, and that's what I like it to be. So at the workshops, it's not necessarily, you know, come along and I'm going to tell you to do A, B, and C, and you're going to go home and you've done that, and, you know, well done. It's more, well, this is it, and this is the wood, and I'm here to support people, but the wood and the fire is actually their teacher. And it doesn't need to be that they're, you know, it might not be the wood and the fire might decide for them that it's not the day for them to get their ember, because there's other things for them to learn first, and that you know, that could be awareness, and that could be calmness, and there's so many sort of deeper elements to it. You know, it takes a lot of concentration, especially when you've been working all day and you're almost there and you see the smoke and you're getting excited. What a very, very common thing to happen, like probably 90% of people that I see at that stage for the first time get overexcited and make a mistake, and boom, all the dust piles everywhere, and they have to start again. So, you know, that sort of discipline, I guess, that emotional discipline, is an element of it as well.
So for someone who's really experienced, and maybe there's no one in our world who is as experienced as people used to be before matches and things like that in Flint, but how fast could they light a fire?
It kind of depends. Like if I've got nothing on me now, and I wander into the bush now, potentially, obviously, I've got to find and shape the sticks that I'm actually going to use. Which, if I know the bush quite well, and I do, I'd probably know where to look. So, you know, potentially within half an hour I could have a fire going, including that time. If I've got a kit already, I can have an ember in less than a minute, or somebody could, you know.
Right.
If you have a really good kit, within 5 seconds from cold, you can get an ember out of it. It really depends on materials you've got. It can be really, really fast.
So what's the kit?
There's different techniques, as we said. So when you asked that, I was thinking of a hand drill technique, which is you get one long sort of finger thickness a stick, and then a flatter, smaller piece which it spins into.
Yeah.
So the long piece you spin between your hands, and it's one that you see, you know, probably most commonly on the TV, and you know, you spin it between your hands, and that speed and the friction creates the heat. So that's my favorite technique, because it's just two pieces of wood. Well, it can actually be one piece of wood, it can be one branch, and you use the thick end and the thin end together.
Oh yeah.
Or the bow drill is technically an easier technique. There's more to it, but
Once you've learned it, it's probably quite efficient.
Yeah. I mean, there's more aspects to it to sort of get right. But from a technique perspective, I can give someone a bow drill, and within half an hour of never doing it before, you know, they can potentially have an ember, which isn't really true of the hand drill. It can take a lot longer to practice the hand drill.
Uh-huh. But, is it just speed? Or?
No. It's many things, and I mean, I'm running workshops as well, but I think it's important to me to say that I don't really believe anyone's a master of fire making. You know, there's never going to be. There's always more to learn, you know, and the fire is always going to teach more and more things, and it's nature, and there's nothing black and white in nature, really.
Yeah.
And you know, you might get it every day for a year and think, yeah, I can do this, and then all of a sudden, it's gone again. And you need to figure out why, and that's going to happen forever, you know, because we're living in an ever-changing world, and you know, the climate and the moisture and the humidity and the weather and the type of woods you use and the condition of the woods and how long they've been dead and where in the bush they are, and there's so many different elements, which is so many different avenues for people to learn, you know. And from this simple thing of fire, making fire, it can teach you so many things that you'd never expect to be learning from a fire workshop.
So you this philosophy of learning, I'm kind of curious, are you applying this to the raising of your son as well, to the children in your life?
I try my best. I think, you know, family life, those closer relationships, you know, whether it's my partner or my kids, or my parents for that matter, definitely bring a mirror to some difficult, deeper aspects of my being, as I think a lot of people, you know. So those challenges are always there, and you know, I think that's part of the beauty of, you know, of having family as well, is you get the opportunity to to do that deeper work on yourself as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, my intention is there, but also, you know, this is my sort of values, and they're their own people as well with their own values. And as a mentor, I think a mentor isn't really, you know, trying to create somebody to do a certain thing. It's trying to support someone of what they want to be, not what I want them to be. You know, the person that they want to be. And I feel I should be supporting my family with that.
But that fits, saying that supporting them to be the person they want to be or are meant to be, instead of the person you want them to be, that fits exactly in my mind too.
Yeah,
you're learning your physical skills in the bush from the experience of doing it, and learning, you know, not from the expert, but from the experience.
Yeah,
that sounds like the same thing.
Okay, sometimes I feel, you know, there's definitely that aspect of me which, you know, I'm so passionate about what I do and loving the idea of sharing that, you know, like, you know.
Oh, yeah.
It's, you see it with, you know, dads, rugby dads and who played soccer and loving their kids, you know, playing for the teams and sort of reliving those experiences. So there's definitely that element that I'd love the kids to just, you know, enjoy and be in love with the bush as I am, but, you know.
They'd be like, Dad, I don't want to learn about fire right now.
But, I mean, it's there. I think it's there with them as well. You know, they see me. They've seen me do it. It's normal. You know,
yeah.
It's even boring for them sometimes to see me sitting there making a fire from two sticks. It's not probably much different from seeing someone light a match for them, because it's just everyday life at home.
Yeah, most kids would be astonished to see something like that happening if they hadn't seen it before. But, it's always a different normal for every kid, I guess, wherever they are.
Yeah. And that's a beautiful thing. And that's a big learning where, you know, their cornerstone and their foundation is that world. The world that they're familiar with is the world where they're so used to seeing someone, you know, caring so much for the natural world around them and for doing things in a slower, more sacred way.
Yeah.
Whether they do it or not, you know, it's ingrained in their childhood.
And I guess you don't have to tell them this is a sacred thing or this is the sacred way to do it. You don't have to, like, speak it at
them. You just have to be it. And I know, you know, Kutatao, that's been a big sort of learning curve for me as well, where, again, there's, you know, trying to have that sacred space, but trying to almost control that sacred space, you know, trying to get the kids, no, you have to, this is a sacred space, so we're going to be, you know, be quiet and we're going to be aware about sort of journeying through over the years to the other side of, well, you know, this is where I am and all I need to do is honor this sacred space, you know, and ask if the kids can have the respect on my part to just allow me to have my sacred time, and I've found that to be so much more powerful, you know.
So
with no expectation to do anything other than just, you know, like, we were always trying to respect each other. That's the foundation of Kutatao, really.
So Kutatao is your kids,
it's my school sessions. I guess my learning space or community space that I hold up on Kariwe 3 days a week through the term.
Yeah, and this is just school age. What age kids?
Yep. Age kids. Yeah, five upwards.
Yeah. And do you teach them about fire?
Yeah.
Or do you leave them to? So here's the thing: do you leave them to learn about fire?
Yeah, I mean, through winter we've got several fires going every day because obviously it's cold. You know, first thing to morning, the sun doesn't actually hit our camp until a little bit later. So sitting around, you know, outside all day, we want to learn about fire, we want a fire, and if I'm not making it for them, then they're really wanting to learn from me, Robs, please help, how do we make this fire? And obviously we don't have matches, you know, we use flint strikes usually we do friction fire. Even with the kids, we'll sit in a circle and we'll do a friction fire to get it going.
I want to give you a scenario that happened with me. We discovered one day the dried up grass on the lawn, you could set that alight, and that was great fun. And then we'd get, there was this 44-gallon drum there. I can't remember why, but it was there. So then we'd roll that over the fire to put it out. So I don't know, it must have been 10 or something. We thought this was great.
Yeah.
But then Dad discovered it, us, and put an end to it. What would you do at Kurataya in that scenario?
Well,
this is us.
I think as a 10-year-old, I think you were excited, and well, by the sounds of it, you know, you were curious and you were exploring fire. And
yeah.
Like, oh, this burns, you know, and fire is an amazing, magical part of this world. You know, it's, you know, even to see it, even in comparison to the bright screens and the movies that we've got access to all the time now, staring into a fire still holds its own, you know, even in that culture, which is quite amazing, really. So I think at Kurataya, there's so much experience and there's been so much exploring with fire, and obviously, you know, I'm there to make sure it's safe, but you know, imagine you did that every day, you know, and you've explored fire and you'd understand fire really well, you know, and you'd respect fire a lot, and you'd be very familiar and you'd really know what fire is in doing so. And in doing so, you're sort of removing the dangers of fire, which come from, you know, lack of understanding and lack of experience with it and lack of responsibility and respect from fire. You know, that's how accidents happen, really.
Would you put a boundary around it? If you thought there was something, if there was actual potential danger?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, I'll always, you know, communicate. But to be honest, I don't experience a lot, you know. I mean, I've got even 5-year-old kids around, but there just seems to be that respect. And I guess I do have rules, you know, a certain place. And if we're having a fire, I don't want anything to be hurt. And I mean, not people, but finding the place to have a fire. And if it is on the grass, you know, there's different techniques. You know, we can cut out a bit of grass like a plug.
Yeah.
You know, if it's a windy day, you don't want to have a fire on top of the ground because obviously the sparks will blow everywhere.
Yeah.
So you have it a little bit underground, so you can sort of cut out a plug of grass, which when you finish your fire, it pops in again and no grass actually dies. You know, it just continues growing in the soil. And it's, you know, no one knows you've had a fire there because you've completely just...
And it's probably got access to some new minerals and nutrients as well.
Yeah. The grass. I mean, carbon, you know, carbon's been used for thousands of years in agriculture, biochar.
In fact, there's some interesting stories that anthropologists have done. Like, I'm thinking of the South American jungles and cultures there. And initially, when white people turned up, they're like, oh, these guys do burning off. And you used to hear that they do a burn off and it kills the soil.
Mm.
But then later on, anthropologists came through and studied it properly, and they were actually using burning to accelerate natural processes or enhance natural processes. Mm. So they weren't like flattening an area. And I can't remember much of the details, but yeah, it was just, it was, they were doing something within the rules of the ecological system, I think.
Yeah.
To enhance growth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I've used biochar. Biochar is the, I guess, the trendy modern term for charcoal used in gardening situations.
Yeah.
And I think the history of it was they discovered it in the Amazon rainforest in a place where, you know, there's so much rain washing out the nutrients of the soil that they didn't feel that there'd been enough nutrients in the ground there to support a sizable civilization. But then they found that not to be true. And then they thought, well, how's that possible? And then they found and they tested the soil and it was, you know, 2-3 meters deep in a mix of sort of human manure, sort of composted human waste and charcoal. And obviously charcoal is, you know, the carbon stays in the ground for forever almost. So this was thousands of years old, but that's how they discovered the biochar trend, I think.
So the 2 to 3 meters of build-up, that was over decades, centuries?
Yeah, probably over centuries. You know, this is kind of big, you know, civilizations thousands of years ago living in the Amazon rainforest. But, you know, it's stable and it acts like a sponge for nutrients, almost like a battery, you know. It stores that nutrient energy in the soil.
Yeah.
And... when the, you know, when the rains come through and the floods come through, the carbon remains, and it allowed them to feed larger numbers of people in a otherwise unfeedable ecosystem.
It, on the face of it, it seems surprising that people with from what we call Stone Age civilizations were able to develop, we'll call it a technology, to enable human survival, and yet we're struggling to do that. We're not succeeding at the moment with our own civilization, with the massive amounts of technology and research and understanding, well, data, the information we have available.
Yeah, I feel, I mean, I don't feel, you know, as humans, I think if we jumped in a time machine now and went back 5,000 years and wouldn't have had a cup of tea with someone from back then, I don't think as people we would have been hugely different. I don't know, just the book Sapiens, which I'd read, and I think he'd come to that same conclusion, you know, given the context. You know, they could still be sitting and drinking tea, doing the crossword in the newspaper 5,000 years ago. But obviously the context was different, and their context was they were really living off the land, you know. There was no globalization. They really relied on the land around them for their survival and, you know, their future survival, to do it in a sustainable way.
You know, one of the problems with time travel?
What's that?
We'd bring all our diseases. We'd bring them COVID-19 and wipe them out.
Yeah. Yeah, they say that, like the start of the agricultural revolution, which is about 10,000 years ago, they say that that's when disease really, you know, became a problem for humanity. Prior to that, life was shorter, but healthier.
Wasn't that much shorter? The Bushmen in South Africa still live into their 60s. And they the reason they're still living the Stone Age primitive lifestyle is because the land is so unproductive that no Western farmers have ever wanted it.
Yeah.
So they're still going about that their way, and they're still living into their 60s.
Yeah.
So yeah. But yeah, the old, I think COVID-19 made me think of the disease thing. And I like time travel science fiction. Okay. But I was thinking, surely every time you go anywhere, you're going to be exposed to a new set of pathogens that your body's not used to.
Mm.
And that's what happened to, like, when Western people first came all around the world on their ships. Like, it was devastating in what is modern-day USA.
Mm.
Yeah, the disease, germs. Was it germs, guns, and steel? Someone wrote a book. That's what they bought.
Mm.
Yeah.
But it's not like the world's, you know, like pathogens or microbial... cells, I guess, entities have always been, you know, and a very important part of this world from the very beginning of this world, you know.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's no time you can go back in time to a place where you're free of viruses and bacteria, because there's no world without them.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, I wonder what the, is it our resilience which has taken the hit over time, or I'm not sure, you know.
Well, that's a whole other interview.
Yeah.
And we are out of time. We've been talking to Robs with our Nature Connection segment, and we've been talking a lot about fire, and in fact, you do have a fire workshop coming up, don't you? So let's tell people about that if they want to learn more.
Yeah, it's going to be Sunday the 10th of July. I haven't spoken to them yet, but it'll either be at Soulscape, where it's where I've the TP zone, where I've run them in the past, or it'll be at Kudatao, which is just off Upper Wainui in the reserve there. It'll be an all-day affair. Everyone is welcome. It'll be quite a gentle community space. It'll be fun and nice to be there. Bring the family, bring the kids, and come and journey with fire.
And if it's raining, do you still light fires?
Yeah, it's just a different challenge.
But
it's about learning, you know. It's not necessarily about coming, but, you know, we'll probably learn more on the wet day.
Yeah.
But because it's community orientated, whatever the weather, we'll have fun because we'll be there together and sharing and enjoying each other's company.
Is there a cost to it?
Yeah. I haven't thought of that yet, but based on what I did last year, I think it will probably be...
give a range, don't give an exact number.
Like between $60 to $80.
Okay, I didn't want to pin you down to a cost. So I turn up and say, "You see it on the radio."
I really should have thought of that before the interview.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. How do people sign up?
I'll be making some posters today, so I'll put some of them around town. We'll have my contact details on. I'll bring one in to you as well for the radio. Okay.
We'll put it on our What's On
guide. Otherwise, kudatayo@mail.com is an email address. Or Raglan's a beautiful small community, so if you ask around, I'm sure you can get hold of me as well.
We've got a great What's On guide now that's much more comprehensive than we've had in the past, so you can just go to our website. We'll put it on there, and you can put the details in there. That's an easy way. All right, Rob, thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Aaron.
And, we'll talk to you again in a few weeks.